Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Brew and Bite Show, the Skateboard Mac, sponsored by the London Mac User Group. Coming up on this week's show, Apple's been busy having a spring clean in saying goodbye to the iMac Pro and the HomePod. Will we finally see the AirPod 3s? And I challenge the panel with all your tech questions, as well as giving our advice on buying a second-hand Mac, as well as a few more surprises. But first up, let's say hello to the panel. This evening we have the wonderful Alistair. How are you this evening?
I'm good, Craig. Good to see you.
It's good to hear. And we have the wonderful Tina. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
And this evening we're also joined by an extremely special guest and a very familiar YouTuber, I'm sure, to Mac users. We're going to say hello to Gary from MacMost. How are you?
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. When a new guest joins us, we always ask an introductory question, and we're going to put Gary on the spot here if he doesn't mind. We're going to ask, what was your first ever Mac product that you owned?
I had a Mac SE 1987. It was one of those all-in-ones. It looked kind of like the first original Mac, but it had two floppy drives in it. I got it when I went to college because I went to a university that everybody got a Mac when they started their freshman year. I had an Apple II before that, though, but my first Mac product was the Mac SE in 87.
How would you say you felt when you first got a Mac? Was it the same experience as you do when you open a box now?
No, definitely not. And I have to say, I didn't like it. I was used to using the Apple II and I was programming it. That's what I would do all the time. And I, you know, the Apple II, you turned it on and you had a prompt and you could immediately start typing basic code or load a program you were working on and things like that. With a Mac, you couldn't do that. You had to have a system on a floppy and then you had to run an app. And if you wanted to program something, you could, you know, had to run a compiler to program something or use some weird new app called HyperCard at the time. So it was a very different experience. And I, for the first few months, I really missed my Apple IIe and didn't really like the Mac, but I got used to it after a while.
You said that you missed some things there. Are there some things in the past that Apple made that you miss now or you wish they could bring back?
Oh, wow. There's tons. I mean, you know, I really miss, like on the Mac, you know, it used to come with like a paint program, right? Where you could just, you know, open an image and edit the image. And I really miss that, being able to use that. I mean, now, of course, we have great apps from, you know, all sorts of developers. And you could do some things with preview and photos and all. But there was something about the fact that you could, you know, today you can edit text files if you want. You could poke around at lots of parts of your Mac. But if you want to edit the pixels in an image, you can't do it with anything that comes with your Mac.
That's really cool. And that subject, I'm going to ask, do you have a favorite design program that you use on the Mac?
Yeah, I think for pure design, I've been really into using Affinity Designer recently. I used, you know, for making graphics for some of my app games that I develop. But most of the time I go with Pixelmator Pro because combines a lot of the, you know, image editing stuff with some design things. So that's what I used to like to make my thumbnails every day for the MacMost videos before I post them to YouTube. So that's kind of my go-to. If I need to edit a graphic and I'm not thinking about it, I just launch Pixelmator Pro.
Shall we jump into some exciting news that's been going on this week? First of all, I think we're going to have to say this week has been the week of the discontinued. So we have seen the discontinuation of the iMac Pro as well as the HomePod. I'm a big fan of the HomePod. I really like that. I don't know, what are your opinions on that?
Well, I've got one sitting right here. I like it. I think it's great. I don't use it as much as I probably should because I've got great speakers set up with my computer, which was always the problem, right? So for the first month, I would play music through it. But then after a while, I got lazy and I would just hit play on the music app and play through my speakers. But yeah, I wish I you know, if it's not selling, it's not selling, I guess. You know, not much. I mean, Apple can keep making it if they're not selling enough.
Alistair, do you have any thoughts on this one?
It was interesting because Apple always loved going for the high end on music. We only have to look at their very expensive headphones to see that they've not too worried about putting things at a high price. But I did notice that Apple took the unusual step of dropping the price by £100, wasn't it? Was it 299 it went down to? I was always very curious by the speaker, and I always thought it looked brilliant and it sounded amazing, but I didn't have the money to go out and buy one. I would love to have got one. I think at £99, it's better price, but I think they got priced out of the market when Amazon started releasing the Amazon Dot. Most people were happy with good enough. And unless you really had FLAC files or high-end subscription to something like Tidal, you probably weren't really getting the benefit of it.
I also think they were quite keen that you would have like a little suite of them. People would buy one or two because there was always the potential that they could reinforce each other, they could have better stereo, but it was just too pricey, or ironically not pricey enough, because the hi-fi people aren't going to be spending that because they want things that plug in to their hi-fi. You know, they want the setup. You know, if they're really obsessive about where the speakers are, connects with your floor, because you can buy those stands with the spikes in them. And so it sort of fell in the middle. It was too expensive for the people that weren't into high fidelity, but not good enough for the people that were. And in the end, it's about money, isn't it? They're more likely to have people buy multiple HomePod minis than people buying one or more HomePods.
No, I'm intrigued. I think the same in regards to where you said about the price point. Maybe they were early to the market with that form of technology, but I think that competitors have released so many different ones that they've just bought down the price and the technology. I think the £100 price point is probably right, and it should have been that from the beginning. I also think that, as Tina said, people that are really interested in music will go out and buy a rather expensive setup, and the HomePod didn't really fit with that kind of market. I own one, yes, and to be honest, I use it just to listen to podcasts, or I have alarms, or Hey Apple Lady, if I want to get something done.
Do you ever speak to it via Siri, or reply via a text message to it, or do any of the other features, any of you? Or do you just use it for playback?
That's a really good question. So I actually turned off the personalized settings, so it doesn't read my text messages, anything like that. It is purely just for audio playback. The one thing that I really like, and I'm glad it works with the HomePod Mini, is the fact that you can literally hold your phone next to it and it will transfer what you're playing instantly to that.
I like what Tina said about it wasn't good enough for the high-end people. I have a little home theater set up, and I thought about moving my HomePod down with the Apple TV, getting a second one and having a stereo pair. And I realized, well, half the time I'm watching my cable box. How would it play through? You know, I'd have to have a second sound system, the existing one. So I'd have to have two sound systems, one that was for the cable box and one that was for Apple TV. And right there, I was out. If there was a way that I could plug in manually those two HomePods so I could just have those play sound for my, you know, regular TV stations, then I would have done it. And they did do that for the AirPods Max, the headphones. The cool thing is, I don't have those, but I thought, well, great, you get these wireless headphones and you get on an airplane and you have to plug in to the seat in front of you to listen. You can't do it. And then somebody pointed out right away that you can. The charging port, if you plug in the adapter to it, the one that Apple already has that converts it to a regular audio jack, it could plug in and the headphones are smart enough to realize what you're doing and allow you to play any audio, so you can use them as wired headphones. They didn't do that for the HomePod. The HomePod has no audio in jack.
No, I think that was a big mistake on their part. I agree with you on that for sure.
Because there are people that will spend the money, but they want something that's super flexible and that will take lots of different inputs. And if you've got a hi-fi and it can't play your files, or it can't play your, you know, vinyl, which is coming back and all the rest of it, people who think, well, if I'm going to spend the money on the speakers, I'd rather spend the money on one set of speakers that does everything that I want.
Maybe they'll come out with the HomePod Max. Maybe that's what this is about. Maybe at Christmas, we'll get the HomePod Max. It'll have inputs. It'll come as a stereo pair. It'll, you know, it'll be $1,000. It'll be everything that everybody wants. And that's why they're discontinuing the HomePod Pro now. And if they do, you know, we're the first to talk about it.
I think, though, the market has changed. When it first came out, there weren't the alternatives that there are now at so many different price points. And so they made a punt. They thought this is what people are prepared to pay, and it turns out they were wrong. And now they've readjusted their price point entry to be the cheaper one. Because for a lot of people, Christmas time, they'll be thinking, well, £100? Yeah, okay, that's not a bad present for someone. Or that's a treat for me because I'm fed up in lockdown. People will buy those almost without thinking, nearly.
But would you also do the same without thinking? Would you have just gone out and bought an iMac Pro? How do you feel about that being discontinued?
I can't see what else they could do. Because even now, when I read review sites, because I'm thinking about changing my MacBook Pro, and I'm waiting, I'm probably like thousands of Apple geeks, sadly reading every rumor, is there going to be a new laptop when it's coming out? They're a victim of the fact that everyone's saying the M1 chip is so amazing. They're comparing, for instance, a 13-inch MacBook Pro and saying, well, with this new M1 chip, it's almost as good as a Mac Pro.
My thought on this was, have they discontinued it because the M chips are going to literally cannibalize the iMac Pro's specs?
Yeah, no, definitely. If they're going to be replacing all of the machines, well, they are going to be replacing all the machines with the M1 or M2 or whatever it's going to be called, just eliminating the iMac Pro, there's one less machine they have to update. But as it was, the high-end iMac, like if you spec'd out the iMac with the best processor and the best GPU and lots of memory and all of that, it was still cheaper than the lowest end iMac Pro. So it was very confusing as which one you should order. You were paying more money for the iMac Pro and had the Vega card in it and you had the Xeon processor in it. But with the M class chips coming out, there wouldn't be that difference anymore. The GPU is on the chip and I would presume have the same chip. So there would be no point having two different classes of iMacs, an iMac and an iMac Pro. Plus even, with the Mac Pro, the one we have now, I don't know why you would buy an iMac Pro. Only if you were in love with the iMac form factor would you buy an iMac Pro over a Mac Pro. Mac Pro is more expensive, but usually if you're buying at that level anyway, either your employer is buying it for you or you're like me and you make your living off your Mac. So you're not afraid to spend money whenever it's time to get a new one. And also the iMac Pro, it's weird. Anybody who wants an iMac Pro is probably going to want multiple screens, right? So a multiple screen system that starts with an iMac Pro is strange because you're not going to have two matching screens. You're going to have an iMac Pro and then either, some black plastic, LG screen next to it, or you're going to spend a ton of money and get Apple's, $6,000 screen. So it just was a weird, when it came out, it made sense. But as things are in 2021, it's a very odd machine to have in the lineup. So I'm not surprised at all that Apple's getting rid of it ahead of coming out with new iMacs.
The other thing which was interesting, in 2017, there wasn't really a possibility of having a sort of really high-end iMac. So if you wanted a powerful computer, you could either go for a Mac Mini or an iMac. Those were the two options. There wasn't a Mac Pro because it was still in development. And they knew that they had high-end workforce needed them. So that would be the animation people, the people who worked in film, the people who worked on podcasts, people who were doing lots of single task actions but needed raw power to get it to work. And so I always thought of it as a stopgap. Then what we would find is that they would change it in a few years' time. I was surprised that there wasn't enough pickup of it. I think what had happened was the price point really scared people, and that's why it didn't take off. But the other thing which I always thought would be interesting on an iMac Pro, wouldn't it be nice to have an iMac Pro with a completely matte screen so you had no reflection or glare off it? But if you do a comparison now, purely on price, compare a Mac Mini M1 versus an iMac, you will find there's £1,000 difference. Because if you want to get performance versus performance, you're not going to go for an i3 because it's going to be too slow. So you go, and you also want an SSD inside it because you want to have the speed to go with. So that means you're going for the i5 SSD version, which what starts $1,700. So then you compare that to a Mac Mini, and you get a monitor, and you're thinking, okay, I can pick up a monitor, base one, 70 quid, something mid-range, maybe 130, 140 quid. Put that to a Mac Mini, and I've spent just over $1,000 versus $5,000 for a Mac Pro, and you're going, iMac Pro, too expensive. And it looked really nice and really slick, but the problem is you can't really expand it. People who buy high-end computers really want expansion. They want to put in massive amounts of hard drive, or they want to put in huge graphics cards, or they want to have lots of stuff coming out the back of it. And the problem I always found from an engineering point of view of the IMAX is it always overheated and they couldn't put big enough fans in to cool the thing down. So I'll be very interested to see if any of them come on the secondhand market at all, or if they're just going to sort of slowly stay there. Because I, as far as I'm concerned, the Mac Pro looks amazing. It's got all this amazing high-end tech in it. And the iMac Pro was just sort of like a testing ground to see which type of people would be interested when the Mac Pro eventually came out.
The natural market for the Mac Pro and the iMac Pro are going to be creatives that are going to have pretty fussy ideas on what they want for their displays. You know, if you're an animator or you're doing high-end film work, you aren't going to be buying a 70-inch LG. You're going to want a particular one. You're going to want to choose the sort of display that works for you. And you're right, why would you then spend your money on an iMac Pro when you don't actually have a choice over the display, whether it's matte or whatever? Whereas with a highly spec'd Mac Pro or Mac Mini now, you pick the display that suits your work.
That's a really good point. And now we're going to put Gary on the spot because, as you mentioned, he makes his career living off of his Mac and making all of your YouTube productions. What machine would you choose and why?
Well, I mean, the machine I've got now is the Mac Pro. You know, I've always, I've been with Mac Pros since the 2008 model is when I did my first Mac Pro. And I've got the 2019 model right now. I've got three screens hooked up to it. I wish they were Apple displays. They're not. I mean, Apple just makes the really expensive one. I would love, and I don't know why Apple has not come out with a display that looks like an iMac, but it's just a display, right? I would buy that in a heartbeat at double the price of like the same display in a little plastic case like they come now. I thought about getting an iMac Pro when it first came out because I had the 2013 Mac Pro. And like Alistair said, you know, it was this in-between time where it was kind of this delay in them coming out with a new Mac Pro at the time. They came out with the iMac Pro and I looked at it and I decided to stick with my Mac Pro until they came out with a new one. But, you know, maybe what you said, Alistair, made me think maybe Apple was experimenting in 2017. Maybe they had one team working on the Mac Pro and they thought that it's going to take another couple of years for us to come out with that. And then another team was saying, maybe people really don't want a Mac Pro. What if we came out with a high-end machine? We called the iMac Pro. We sold that. And maybe everybody would be happy with that. And let's see what happens. And it turns out, no, people still wanted a Mac Pro and they went ahead with that. But maybe there was enough question for them to think this might settle it. We do an iMac Pro, that's the high-end machine, and we don't have a Pro machine anymore.
It makes a lot of sense because if you look at the graphics cards and the Intel chips, which they were going with, they were experimenting with them at the time and they were wanting to get feedback. So they asked the developers, what do you think of this? What would you rather deal with it? They wanted to see if any of the manufacturers came out with any special versions to deal with the special new cards with it. Nothing came out. Look what happened when the Mac Pro comes out. Huge interest in it. Huge amount of people saying, well, actually, we want a card which was this much better. We wanted this. This hits all our requirements and exceeds it. So that must have come from all the research they got from the iMac Pro, where they said, well, this is the best we can put in an iMac. And the developers come back and go, yes, but what we really want is something 10 times as fast, not 4 times as fast.
And price is no object. Yeah.
Yeah, price is no object. And I remember listening to Alex Lindsay on the day it came out, and he said the types of people who buy the Mac Pro are people who charge out $1,500 an hour to do the work because these are guys who are doing very high-end resolution. You know, they're working for Disney, ILM, LucasArts. They're producing amazing high-end animations, or it's the other end of the scale. They're doing really big 4K RED videos, which need to be crunched down and be able to be thrown back up onto YouTube. And they were getting fed up of having to sort of wait for, you know, to deal with it. And you want some massive amount of hard drive space so you can dump that 4K video in and then throw it up. And the iMac never really hit that market in the Pro line. properly. And if you look at when the 5K came out, there was a sort of slight interest in some Final Cut fans, but then I looked at it, and I'm going, this machine is not fast enough. It's getting too hot and cutting down on itself. It's thermal throttling itself. It can't really do compression quite well. It can't really work at the speed that you need it to do. And so I thought, I'm going to leave off. I live off a 2010 Mac Pro. At some point, I would like to get the new Mac Pro. I like the old Mac Pro, the mid-between one, the black one, but mainly because of the Star Wars references, and I thought it looked quite cool. It definitely had that sort of Darth Vader look to it, which I thought was cool, you know, as it takes off the helmet. So it looked really cool. But trying to find them is virtually impossible because there is no secondhand market for the Mac Pro black ones because everyone's keeping them as collector's items.
I have one and I actually priced how much it would cost to sell it to the local Mac store and they gave me a price and I haven't, that was 3 months ago. I haven't taken it over yet because I've kept it. I got to say the 2013 Mac Pro, I bought that thing after it first came out. I used it every day, of course, you know, 8 to 15 hours a day from 2013 all the way to the middle of 2020. I basically hooked it up and I used it so much, it never gave me a bit of trouble. I never didn't do anything to it. I never upgraded it. I just kept it as, you know, the specs I originally got. I never touched it. I mean, it just sat there and did everything I asked of it day after day after day until the day I got my new Mac Pro. It was a great machine and the expensive price of that, it wasn't that expensive really, was worth every penny. I hope this Mac Pro that I have now, way more expensive. Hope it does as well. I'm not going to have it as long because they're going to come out with an M1 Mac Pro at some point, probably next year, maybe the end of this year. And I'm probably going to want that. So this one's not going to last as long, you know, but you know, so far this thing has done the same thing since I got it almost a year ago. It just sat there under my desk and hasn't complained about a single thing I've asked it to do. That's what you want.
The interesting thing I discovered also is, did you see that they're using GPUs now instead of Intel chips? It's all to do with how much you can crunch numbers down. And one of the areas this came in quite interesting is with how you could do it for encryption in relation to Bitcoin or other factors. The power out of these machines is really powerful. And so it'd be very interesting to see if we get some of that technology seeps down into the iMac and you end up with a very new design of an iMac, which is sort of somewhere between the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro. Mm-hmm. So I think my thinking is you'll still have the Intel Mac Pros and then they'll just very slowly bring in the iMacs. And once they've resolved all the iMacs and the Mac Pro laptops, then they'll bring out the Mac Pro.
Yeah.
Because it's going to take some time. These things are going to be very powerful. And you want probably the M3 before we get there, I reckon.
The thing that makes the Mac Pro is these GPUs. But if the GPUs are going to be part of the M-class chips, then how do they differentiate the high-end iMac and like the 16-inch MacBook Pro from the Mac Pro? Will they have a special chip that's the special like M2 Pro chip that's twice as fast or has 10 times as many cores or something like that? Or will they say, oh, this is a special chip that can use a GPU? And then what GPU will they use? Because NVIDIA GPUs and all the AMD GPUs, they're all made for Intel chips. So it doesn't make sense that they're going to go and say, well, we figured out a way to get the Radeon Pro GPU, you know, have that work with our M1 chip. That doesn't make sense. What would either make sense is somehow having a better GPU on the chip or having a special GPU that Apple makes. You know, we don't know. The other thing they could do is have multiple processors. Would be interesting to see if there was a Mac Pro that had four M1 chips in it. You know, since it's just multiple cores anyway, why can't they just stack a bunch of chips and tell them all to work together? I don't know. We'll have to see. They obviously have a plan. They know what they're doing. There's rumors about what it's going to look like and everything. So somewhere inside of Cupertino's, you know, Apple's Cupertino headquarters, they know what they're coming out with.
I have to ask, if there's more chips or GPUs, will there be more teams designing wheels for the Mac Pro? And did Gary buy a set of wheels?
You can get 8 wheels on the new one. For the record, I did not buy wheels for my Mac Pro. I don't need them. But I could see, you know, if your Mac Pro is sitting next to a you're in a movie studio or, you know, a super collider or something like that, and you're in a situation where it needs to move from one workstation to the other, I guess you get the wheels. You know, you probably have multi-million dollar budgets and the wheels are nothing.
There's got to be somewhere out there where someone's making alloy wheels for Mac.
Well, they do. Yeah, you can. I think you can get third-party wheels if you don't want to use the wheels. And then I've seen people, you know, put a skateboard under. It's like, here you go. Instead of that, for $50, you get a cheap skateboard and you put the Mac on the skateboard and you can move it around.
In terms of moving on products, does any of you have any thoughts on the rumored AirPod 3s? My question is what are they going to do different to the AirPod Pros? What's going to set them apart? There's all these wonderful renders of what they're going to look like, or the stem is slightly smaller, but what do they do different?
Things I've read that they said that it won't have noise cancelling, and most of the rumours seem to be saying that they won't have like silicon chip tips and they won't have that seal. So that would make noise cancelling very difficult without that. That's what I've seen. So, I mean, they've got to differentiate. If you can, don't they say the price points could be about 150, 160? Well, if you can get noise cancelling for about 150, 160, why pay for AirPod Pros? So I think it's going to be noise cancelling. No noise cancelling.
Do you also think that it might be just like they do with the phone? Sometimes they do an S version. Is this the S version of the AirPods?
They might do. They might price it down because when they did an experiment with Amazon and they were priced at $129, they sold way more. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Apple says, okay, we're going to make an S version and we're going to price them down to $129 or pounds and we're going to keep it at this low price, sort of price down the competitors so that we're just above the £100 mark and they might bring out slightly different colors. So you might have like a gray version, a space gray and a white version, or a black version. So they'll have three colors. You have a gray, a white, and a black. And that's what they'll do. And they'll be £129 and they'll be very popular because they've noticed that they were extremely popular for commuters. And they were incredibly useful, I found, when you're wearing a mask because you don't have the cables getting in way of the straps going around your ears. So they can be very useful. What I would like is ones that have longer battery life because it's invariably one will always go quicker than the other because you put one in your ear just to answer the telephone call. And then invariably that one side will invariably go down quicker. So I'd like to have a system where you could, for a small amount of money, go in and say, look, the left-hand side or the right-hand side has failed. Can I just trade this in and get part exchange, get one at a discounted price and then put it back in and it pairs together and goes from there? That would be quite a nice idea.
The main difference between the Pro and the regular is that noise canceling, but not just the noise canceling, the other side of it, the transparency mode, which I love the transparency mode. I go on walks and bike rides and I listen to audiobooks. The transparency mode allows me to basically walk around or cycle around and it's like I'm not wearing them at all. And when you're listening to audiobooks or podcasts for that matter, there's a lot of silence in between all the words. So you really can, you know, hear other things, cars, other pedestrians, that kind of thing. And it's great in transparency mode, but then the noise canceling is also excellent. And, you know, that's why if they're not going to have noise canceling, they don't need the silicon tips on them. There's really no point to that. I actually don't like the silicon tips. I hated earphones that had those before. I really loved the original AirPods because they didn't have that. And I had the, you know, for 3 years, I really enjoyed the original AirPods. Love my AirPods Pro, but, you know, if there was some way to do noise canceling without those silicon tips, I would much rather have that. I like the simplicity. I like the design of the original ones. I loved how they didn't fall out of my ears, despite the fact that every other set of earphones I ever had, whether they were Bluetooth or wired, they always fell out of my ears or were uncomfortable in some way. And then the AirPods, for some reason, Apple figured out how to get it right. And they fit well and they never fall out of my ears. I mean, 3 years. I can't believe I had those for 3 years and never lost one.
Do you think that the new rumored pair will have a Find Me feature? So we've seen lots of rumors about AirTags. Do you reckon there'll be a Find Me feature in the new AirPod 3s?
That would be really cool. That would be the new big new feature that would be different than the AirPods 2 if they came out with that. While I never actually had them drop out of my ears and lose them, I have misplaced them occasionally, right? The in's the case. So I've, you know, had the case, I was doing something different, I was wearing a different jacket, whatever it was, and I was like, I can't find them now. And the current Find My feature with AirPods completely useless. Never helped me actually locate them. I had to, you know, do it the old fashioned way, retrace my steps, and eventually I found them. But that would be amazing if they came out with that. I don't know if they could do that, depending on how much space that technology really took up inside. I mean, putting them in a little AirPod, that would be tough.
The other one I thought would be quite interesting is, was it a couple of weeks ago, they came out with research pulled from the iPhones all about the amount of noise that people listen to and their surround sound around them, the environments they're in, and deafness in general. And one of the things that I thought would be quite interesting is if Apple worked well with people who have existing earphones, you know, so they've got hearing aids, and they might produce a version which works with hearing aids. So that might be bone conductive technology, which doesn't interfere with the existing headphones. So they could quite easily produce something which would work in association with, or these ones could be better at determining sound around you to stop you from getting deaf, but give you better sound quality. So they might be better for environmental difference. So these are sort of subtle things, because if you read their press releases, they've been talking about noise in the environment. They've been talking about how can we help the community at large. And I'm thinking, well, that would be quite interesting, because no one's really catering for that older age group or nice looking sort of, I want to listen to music. I want to be able to connect my iPhone to my hearing aids, which you can already do via little Bluetooth connections. But wouldn't it be nice if you could have something where you didn't have to sort of switch or have these expensive connections? It would be quite interesting. They might pair up with a hearing aid manufacturer or something.
It would be interesting as well as if you could actually have a function where you could swap your headphones and they could become hearing aids. That would be really interesting. There'd be people that wouldn't feel so labeled, because it just looks like they're listening to music.
I mean, you can do that now with the current AirPods and an iPhone. You know, you could set it up for the AirPods to work as hearing aids, but they're not, you know, medical grade. You know, it's more consumer level, you know. So, and there are people that will take their iPhone and either place it closer to, say, the television, and then have the AirPods in, and then they could, it'll actually, you know, help you hear what's there. Or sometimes if you just point the bottom of the iPhone towards whatever it is you want to listen to, it'll actually pick up more. It's not quite the same. I know there's this whole, at least here in the United States, there's this whole idea that, you know, hearing aids have to be a medical grade device, and there has to be companies, and you have to get tested, and they have to customize it for you, and you have to get it through your insurance company and all this stuff. And that's different than what the AirPods have. But, you know, you could use it as kind of hearing aids now. It would be interesting if Apple would just do more towards that. Transparency mode does on the AirPods Pro work a little bit like that, where it's canceling out some noise and helping you hear voices better. Because the whole idea of transparency is for you to hear voices while you're listening to music or while you're listening to audiobooks. So if you simply have them in and you're not listening to anything and have transparency mode turned on, you can hear people's speech a little clearer than you would otherwise. So I have an experiment with that. I don't have any major hearing issues, but I'd love to hear, you know, from other people if somebody's ever tried using them as hearing aids.
I'd like to know that too. Hopefully there's somebody out there that can send us an email and let us know, because now that's opened up a whole nother intriguing aspect of using an AirPod.
Well, I was at the park the other day, and I was listening to, I had transparency mode on, and I was listening to music, and I turned it off just to hear the sounds around me, but I didn't bother to take the AirPods Pro out of my ears. And with transparency mode, I could hear people's conversations around me in the park really clearly. And then I thought, oh, you know, am I hearing that normally, or is it because of the transparency mode? So I took the AirPods Pro out of my ears, and I couldn't hear them as clearly. So it was like I was eavesdropping on people's conversations. I mean, there were people that were, you know, at the next bench over or whatever, that, you know, they weren't talking in private. I'm sure anybody with really good hearing could hear them, but it felt like I could hear people better with the AirPods Pro in transparency mode. And I wonder, I should have experimented with actually turning on my, using that feature on my iPhone where it picks up from the microphone and pointing it at different people and trying out different things.
The spy AirPod.
Yeah. Nobody would suspect you. Everybody's wearing AirPods at the park.
That's true.
Craig, do you ever use your headphones at all for when you're running or when you're doing any exercise, which may jog them out more than usual? Because one of the rumors I was reading is that Apple may go for a sports version of them.
That's a really good question. So I'm very much like Gary. I like walking a lot, but I will listen to an audiobook or a podcast rather than having some form of physical running that's going to knock an AirPod out of my ears. But you do have a really good point. Apple obviously paired up in the early days with Nike. There was Nike versions of a watch. There was Nike versions of, do any of you remember the shoe accessory that they made that was in partnership with Nike that you tied into your shoelace?
You all knew people who used it because, you know, they were like serious runners.
So this evening we've talked about lots of interesting new tech and our rumors, but the questions are, what happens to my old tech? What do I do if I want to sell on my device? Or what if I'm now in the market for a new recycled machine? Because to be honest, now is a really good point to pick up some interesting tech at a lower price, because there's so many new things on the market. We thought we would ask, what do we do in that case? And first up, I shall hand you over to Alistair with a theory, is if I'm going to buy a secondhand computer, what would I do first? What am I going to be looking for?
So firstly, you'd probably want to work out what it is that you wanted to buy. Do you want desktop or laptop? If it's a computer, this is. I'm always a bit skeptical about buying secondhand iPhones because you're never quite sure of the battery life of the iPhone. Or has the user of the iPhone been a good user or a bad user? But on the computer, once you've worked out what it is you wanted to buy, then you would look at where you could buy it. So you could either buy it at maybe a CEX store, or you could buy it on eBay, or you could buy it from some store which is selling it. But the most important thing to work out is, what do you need to check, and are you going to get ripped off? What is a good price to pay for iMac 27-inch 2010 model? And there was also a website, what was it? Mac to Sell, I think it was, where you could put in the price of what your Mac was worth and you could work out the price. But Apple also have it on their own website, and it always prices it ridiculously low depending on which country you're in. So Ireland is slightly different than the UK. America is slightly different than Canada because it takes into account local regional taxes and different factors. So if you want to find out what the base model is, always go to the Apple website. Second thing to look at is, from an engineering point of view, you always look at, especially laptops, is the Mac damaged? Is it missing any of the little black feet? Does it have dents to the USB port or the Ethernet port? Is the MagSafe connector dirty? Little tiny things like that. Got little water sensors built underneath of the laptop. The other thing is to use the sensors. Does it smell odd, or does it vibrate? If you put your hand to the back of the iMac, does it get really hot, so hot that you could fry an egg on the back? Because a lot of the 27-inch 2010, 2011, 2012 models all had a heat issue, especially the 2010 model. And most of them would have graphics card failure or power failure. So just work it out. There's a series of apps I use for testing computers. I think some of you may have come across the Apple hardware test. So if it's the original hard drive and it hasn't been replaced, you can press Command and D, and that normally builds into diagnostic mode. But if the hard drive has been replaced, it doesn't have diagnostic mode on it anymore. So then you can boot from an external drive and you can run third-party utilities, such as, if you want to test the drive, you would run DriveDX for telling you how good the hard drive is. I use Machine Profile, which is a brilliant little app you can get for free off the App Store for working out what the model is, the serial number, what's the best operating system to put on it, what's the battery life like inside the computer. And if you want to do a quick test, you run TechTool, and those are brilliant. Unfortunately, none of those you can do in most stores, because the stores say, we've tested it, we'll give you 90 days. If it breaks, you have to bring it back to us. Also, Apple does do their own refurbished program, but you tend to get better Macs in America than you do in UK most of the time. What do yourself, Craig?
I do various different things. I agree with you, Alistair, on look at the physical connection ports. A classic one is definitely on some of the older Macs where there's an Ethernet port, check that they're not bent. That seemed to be quite a common one where someone's tripped over the cable, and especially unibody MacBooks, they've got a slight bend to the back of them. The other one for MacBook Pros is the black hinge at the back of the display. This is quite a common one. You see quite a lot secondhand market where they're cracked slightly in the corner. That might not necessarily be from bad use of the machine or how it's been looked after. It could actually be to do with the heat distribution inside. So the machine's actually warming up and starting to crack at the back, especially on the 13-inch MacBook Pro models. That's quite a common one. The other thing I would say is if you do have physical access to the device, try and delve into the battery cycles to have a look at what the life is like. Also a tricky one, Alistair can chip in on this, I'm sure. What would you say is a healthy battery cycle? Because every machine has slightly got better and better as we've gone along.
So if we take the standard MacBook Pro, not the MacBooks because they're slightly different, but the MacBook Pros, Apple recommends, say, anything over 1,000 cycles is considered out of warranty and it needs to be changed. And the way you can check that is if you hold down the Alt key or Option key, go onto the Apple menu on the top left, and it says System Profiler, and then it will show you the battery, and then it will tell you how many cycles your battery has gone through. Other thing to follow up on your other suggestion is to check also that it's charging, because some MacBooks don't charge when they get to a certain age. And the most common one I come across, and believe it or not, this is the strangest one, check that the trackpad actually works, because sometimes the batteries can explode and it pushes up against the trackpad and the trackpad doesn't work. And then you'll notice if you turn the MacBooks over that there's a slight bulge. Someone's taken out the screws so that all the screws have popped because it's only aluminium on the bottom and you have to replace the battery. And there's some quite good sites you can buy, but I wouldn't buy batteries from eBay because you might end up with exploding batteries or something.
I mean, I think you've got it mostly covered there. You know, do we mention checking the Wi-Fi connection, making sure Wi-Fi is working? Because that's something you occasionally see. Somebody's, you know, you have to always remember somebody's trying to sell this Mac for a reason. Hopefully the reason is they bought themselves a new one because it's faster and better. But sometimes people try to sell them because they're not working properly. So maybe Wi-Fi is an issue. You know, if you can test that out, that'll be great. Every key on the keyboard, of course. You know, it's, and that battery, don't just think about the battery as a yes or no proposition, like the battery works or doesn't work. But, you know, how does that affect the price? You're expecting to get a MacBook that's a couple of years old and you think you want to use it for the next 5 years, but it's got 600 cycles on the battery and it still shows condition is good, 600 cycles. But think that, you know, if you're going to be using that for the next 5 years, you're not going to get away with not having a battery replacement at some time. Whereas you could if you bought a new one. So add that amount, find out what it's going to cost to replace the battery in that thing. You may not need to do it this year, but it's going to be in there in the future.
What would you say if I was going to buy a secondhand Mac at the moment, what machine would I be looking at?
I would say be careful of the MacBooks, you know, the single port, because they were traditionally bought by early adopters. And from my experience, they were bought by people who weren't really tech-minded and bought it because it was small and portable, and then got annoyed that they could only have data or power. They were also the very first generation with the keyboard or butterfly keys, so they could often have maybe the odd one or key dodgy key on them. But the most common thing I've discovered is that people would buy something and then not buy big enough internal drive. And then you'd end up with a 128 internal drive, or 128 gigabytes. And if you take out 60 gigabytes for the operating system and, you know, a couple of programs, you know, Word and Pages, you're going, oh, I haven't got much space for anything else. So that's the other minor thing. I say Mac Minis are quite good traditionally because you can upgrade them, but there are a few models which you wouldn't buy because they're a bit hard to fix. The new generation iMacs are very difficult to change internal components unless you'd like to take a scalpel to the screen and open it up. I know from experience that some of the Macs are very easy to repair, but I'll throw it back to you, Craig. What would you look for if you were buying a mobile device, so an iPad or iPhone? Which models would you go for and which ones would you ignore?
Oh, that's a very nice question. I'm a huge fan of iPad Pros. If I was to buy a secondhand one, I would definitely look at the ones that have a USB-C port. I would ignore the early ones where it's got the Lightning port, purely for the fact that there are so many things out there now that are USB-C friendly. So you can plug in a hard drive and watch a movie on the iPad, or even when it comes down to podcasting, you can actually plug in a USB audio device. If it was an iPhone, that's a tricky one. I've never bought a secondhand iPhone. I know they're really popular in terms of the Apple refurbished store. And some interesting news this week, Amazon have just launched a refresh store. So they're actually selling Apple products that are refurbished. The intriguing one with this is that they are selling, so example being an iPhone. Yes, it's a refurbished device. It's been checked. The battery is okay and things like that. But it will actually be shipped with a third-party cable and charger. If somebody wants a real big bargain at the moment, there is quite a lot of iPhone 10s that have just dropped on there that are reasonably priced for around £250. I don't know, what would be your thoughts on buying an iOS device secondhand?
I'd be interested in how old it is, in as much as you need to be aware of what version of iOS you're likely to be able to update it to. So if it's too old, you'll get to the stage when you can't do anything with it. I speak as one who has an iPad Air that we can't do anything with because it's so old that there's virtually no apps that work on it. So I think whenever you buy something secondhand, it's not just about the what you're buying, it's also how long you want it to last. So if you're buying, like, you're thinking, okay, I'm going to buy a secondhand iPad because I'm a bit hard up at the minute and I want it to last 2 years, well, then you'll know that in 2 years' time you're planning to replace it. So you might risk something that's older. Whereas if you're going to be buying something that you're going to be hanging on to for 3-4 years, it might be worth spending a bit more cash at the outset.
The most common one I see when I get asked to go and speak to people or see clients is, I've just bought a new iPhone and I'd like to have all the data transferred from this old iPhone to this new iPhone. What's the best way to do it? So I think I'll get Craig's opinion on this one as well, or maybe Gary's opinion. The second one is, what do I need to do to my existing iPhone 10 or iPhone 8 to hand it over to another family member, which is the most common thing that you see? You know, it's the hand-me-down phones, isn't it? And is there any do's or don'ts you don't want to do with it? I know from what I've heard of the American podcast, there's a company called Gazelle. I don't know if they're still in business. I'm always a bit wary about security when buying secondhand phones, because I can't trust what the firmware is on, especially if it's an Android phone. I'm always a bit sort of, the security on here is dubious because you can't tell if this has been deliberately put on here or if it's malicious. The person who used it came from a country where they may have put other stuff on it, or a strange regime put stuff on. So I'm always a bit cautious on those ones. So I'll open it up. Does anyone get asked to advise when they're handing phones to another family member? Or do you ever give your devices to other family members or relatives? Or
my sister now says to me, can you let me know what new phone you're getting? Because I'll be having it at some stage. And I want to know that I like it as well. That's basically what she comes down to. And normally what I do is I just reset it. I put it back to factory settings. And it used to be via iTunes, but now it's using the sidebar thing. But you can actually wipe it that way.
Apple have ridiculously high-end security on their iPhones. And unless you've got the money to buy zero-day exploits from Zenodium, we'll put a link in the show notes, it's virtually impossible to get into an iPhone. Even transferring data when you know you've got a backup on iTunes is very hard. So there's a reason why Apple pays £1 million for zero-day exploits, because it's so hard to get in.
But it is interesting, because the last time when I bought my new phone, updating the data was really interesting, because in the end, I backed it up to iCloud, because there seemed to be some doubt about if I just transferred it across, because my Apple Watch data was encrypted in some way, and it must be the standard encryption, because God knows I don't do anything clever. It basically said that a lot of my fitness data wouldn't transfer across, and the easiest way to do that was to use iCloud.
The mistakes people make, both when handing down or getting a used device, you got to wipe it when you, you know, giving to somebody else, not only because it's best for your security, but it's best for, you know, the person getting it not to have to deal with, you know, whatever settings you've had or whatever. So always, you know, factory reset, whether it's a Mac or an iPhone or iPad, factory reset. So the person gets a clean new device. And if you're reselling it, obviously you definitely need to factory reset it. You don't want it to leave your hands, go into a stranger's hands with any of your data or any remnants of your data on it. But the bigger thing I hear all the time is people who buy a used Mac or an iPhone or an iPad, months later, they run into trouble and they're asking me a question. And it comes out that they got a device that already had stuff on it. There was already a user account on the Mac and they just started using that user account. You know, they were given, the person I bought it from gave me his password and I've been using it, you know, ever since. I'm like, no, you don't want to do that. Ideally with like a Mac or an iPhone or an iPad, you get the device used and it appears to be wiped. It's like it's new. You know, it comes with the welcome screen and all of that. There's no date on it, but you don't settle for that. You then go ahead and reset the entire thing anyway, even though it looks like it's reset, just to be sure, since you're at the state where you have nothing on it that's yours, go ahead, boot your Mac to restore mode, do the equivalent for the iPhone and iPad, do the restore, put the operating system on it. You know now that it's clean and you're starting fresh with your own user account. But I'm amazed at the people that don't do that, or people that will maybe create their own user account, but then talk about how there's this other user account on this used Mac that I bought. I'm like, okay, so you just bought that? Oh no, I bought it like a year ago. Oh, you've been using it, and there's this stranger's user account sitting on your Mac. That's not good. Chances are, though, nothing's going to happen, right? I mean, you know, it's like something to be alarmed about, but it's not the kind of thing where like, oh, you're in trouble. Probably everything's fine. But you really should, just to make sure, wipe that Mac, wipe that iPhone, wipe that iPad when you get it or before you, even if you're giving it to recycling, you know, you're sending it into a company to be recycled. It's too old to be used by, you know, anybody for anything. You're donating it to a school. People do this all the time. They'll just donate their Mac to a school and they don't wipe it. You got to wipe it, install, you know, get up to the point of the operating system where it's like the welcome screen, welcome to your new Mac, and stop right there. Don't create a user account or anything like that. Turn it off. It's ready to go. And that's when you sell it.
I think the most common things I come across, if you're moving from, say, an iPhone 10 to an iPhone 12, two things which come up, which people don't think about. Number one, the iPhone 12 comes with a Lightning to USB-C cable in the box. It doesn't come with a Lightning to USB-A, which is what you plug to your charger. So you might need to get a new charger, or it might not connect to your current computer. Second problem, your iPhone might not be at the current update. So your backup may be 14.4, but the iPhone that you've bought from Apple, which has been sent to you from the Apple store, may be 14.3 or 14.2, depending on what the warehouse was set up. You can't move your backup from iCloud or from iTunes until you upgrade that iPhone to the same version. So the first thing you need to do when you get an iPhone is upgrade it to the nearest version. Then you can do data transfer. The second thing to remember is if you're transferring from iCloud and you've got 70 gigs worth of data, you're going to have to download each app. And then each app will then have to download the data over your Wi-Fi. If you're impatient, you might want to connect it up via cable to your computer, and the iTunes backup will then work across the computer slightly faster, but it will take hours at times if you have a lot of information. So just bear that one in mind. The other one I will point out, which a lot of people misunderstand, if you buy a computer from someone and it already has software installed on it, the legality of that software is sometimes dubious, because either A, they were a student and they're selling it because they're leaving the country and they can't take the iMac on the plane with them. And so the license is tied to a student account and may expire at the end of the academic year. Or B, it may have come from dubious sources. So bear that one in mind. The other thing I will always say is that look at what you need the iMac or the computer to do for you. don't go and buy a computer with a really small hard drive, because you won't find it will do anything. So at least go for something which is the same size you need or slightly bigger. The other thing I will say is if I was going to buy a MacBook Pro today, I'd probably go for either the 15-inch or the 13-inch 2015 model. And I'll tell you why. That was the last model which still had all the ports on the side, because afterwards you ended up going to USB-C, and that means you're now a member of Dongle Town, as you have to buy all the dongles, and that costs money, and then they don't always work, and it's complex.
I agree with you on the 2015 aspect. I also think they're quite a nice machine in terms of if you are looking to sell it, it's quite an easy option to protect your data by just swapping out the hard drive. That way there's no physical data being transferred and it is literally a clean version of the operating system.
Does anyone have their preferred place to go to for checking computers, both either England or America?
Yeah, where would we sell a secondhand Mac, Gary? Come on, give us all of your expertise on this one.
I mean, people sell here on, you know, yeah, obviously eBay and Craigslist, but in America, it's actually really popular local user groups. I guess we have Nextdoor. When you post something for sale or look for something for sale, it's always in your neighborhood. You can't post like beyond one neighborhood beyond you. So it's always somebody nearby. And there's always a little more security because every, you know, you somebody's house and there's an address and it's like somebody lives in your neighborhood. There's less temptation to somebody to sell you a lemon or something like that because they know where you live. I mean, there's a lot of fraud I see, especially on, you know, people buying online. You got to factor that in. I mean, if you're going to be buying used Mac, you know, you always want to buy a 2 or 3 year old Mac used, not buy the new one. Eventually, you're going to get either outright fraud, like the you're not going to get the Mac or it's going to be broken, or slight fraud, you know, the battery's not as good condition as they said it was, or, you know, something's wrong with it, but they haven't disclosed it. And, you know, you find out 6 months later, it's all of this. So it's always a risk that you got to factor in. You factor in the battery might need to be replaced soon. You add that to the price. You add in that maybe every once in a while you get one that's broken and, you know, or you get ripped off somehow. You add all those things in and suddenly the price for a brand new MacBook Air looks pretty good. You get it from Apple, you get the 1 year warranty on it, or actually isn't it? I think it's more in the UK. And the great thing about Apple is compared to other companies that sell electronics historically, you know, something's wrong with it. You take it in and, oh, let's take a look at it. And is this under warranty? All that stuff. Apple's more, you bring something in, oh, something's wrong with it. Oh, here's a new one. Or here, we'll repair that. Don't worry about it. We'll have it fixed. We'll have it for you tomorrow. We'll have it for you in 48 hours. I had a MacBook Pro that had the butterfly keyboard issue. So I had two keyboard replacements with it. And that was bad that it had this issue that I had to have two times have it replaced. But neither time did I pay a penny. And both times, Apple had it back to me in, like, I think it was about 48 hours. That it was just such a pleasure to deal with that, as opposed to, you know, how, like, say if something was wrong with my car. And I had to take that in and it was under warranty. It would be this whole thing where they would try to, you know, blame it on me and try to say, oh, this isn't covered. And I'd have to fight them on it. And eventually they'd fix it and it would take them too long and they wouldn't be done right. And Apple just takes care of stuff. You factor that all in. And, you know, I don't think I've bought refurbished Macs, but I've never bought a used Mac.
And it's interesting as well, I think, because Macs do last a long while. I can remember before I had Macs, I had a little Sony. It was before netbooks came in. And so I'm one of those people that like a MacBook because I like the size factor because I used to take it into work. So I had this Sony, but really pricey. And it lasted 3 years. So I went into the Sony shop and said, look, what can I do with this? And basically they went, it's junk. Good luck. How long have you had it? And I said, oh, 3 years. And the man went, that's pretty good for a laptop. I expect it to last longer than 3 years. Now, I'm sitting talking to you lot on a seven-year-old MacBook Pro, and it's running. Actually, it could run Big Sur, but it runs and it does everything. It's still a very usable machine. I think there's a longevity. So that's one of the reasons why I buy a new Mac or I'd buy a refurbished Mac. I think I wouldn't buy used because I know that if I'm going to buy something, I'm probably going to keep it for 6-7 years. So it's worth spending the cash at the beginning to get something that I can trust.
That leads nicely onto our technical questions. Our first question came in from Wesley. Does any of us have any experience using the old Thunderbolt Apple monitor with Big Sur? Since he's done the upgrade, he's had some performance issues and wondering, is this to do with the software or is it the model itself? So I actually am a big fan of Apple monitors. I do have a Thunderbolt monitor and I've not seen any issues. However, this might be well into the aspect of Big Sur's support and operating system questions. But to be honest, there's so many monitors out there that Apple is not going to be able to support every one of them straight away. I don't know if any of you have opinions on that. I've not found problems with it.
First thing that comes to mind would be check the cables, check the connections, because that often can lead to problems. Because Apple traditionally have the firmware baked into the monitor and on the computer. So if one app is going to test anything, it's going to test it with its own equipment. So you'd expect it to work across the board. But if it's flickering, traditionally think that that might be a connection issue or it might be something inside. The other thing to do is listen to see if you hear any crackling, because sometimes that's a short circuit behind the monitor on the electrical side. I've also had it whereby certain computers cause the issue. So you could have Big Sur on two computers and it only works on one computer where the fault comes from because it's some compatibility issue.
No, I don't think that one's necessarily a quick fix. Let us know how you get on. Question number two, how do I turn off an alert sound for a specific app? Certain apps make unnecessary beeping sounds way too often and it drives me crazy. How can I turn it off for one particular app? This is for the Mac.
I mean, the answer really is that if an app is going to, the app itself should have volume or sound controls in it. That's the ideal solution. That's the way the system is designed. So it depends on the app. Check to see if, you know, assuming this is a third-party app of some kind, if any kind of settings are in there for sound. Like, for instance, in the game world, you know, any game would have sound settings, right? A whole bunch, usually it's a whole screen full of sound settings, music and, you know, voices and sound effects and ambient sound and all that. But, you know, regular app that just maybe has a couple of alerts that should have some sound settings in there to mute those or set the volume. If they're notification sounds, of course, if they're not actually sounds coming from the app itself, but they're at, you know, the app throws up a notification in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. It's a standard Mac notification. Then you can turn those off in System Preferences, Notifications. Go to find the app in the list, and there's a checkbox there for sound. So you could turn that off if that's what it is. Otherwise, well, the first thing I would do is complain to the developer saying, your developer makes too much noise, and you have no option to turn it off. Sometimes you do that, and they'll come and say, oh, We do. It's under options, not settings or preferences, you know, whatever. So sometimes you discover the functionality that way by asking for help. Otherwise, there are apps out there, I think third-party apps, that will be a system extension that will then allow you to, you know, play with the audio settings in a variety of ways. It's a pretty heavy-handed solution, though. Usually people using those are, you know, sound professionals or somebody that has lots of different music apps and things they need to do. Installing one of those, paying for installing one, seems to be a pretty heavy-handed solution for there's just an app that beeps too much. Like I would check with the developer first and find out what they've got to say before going that route. You may end up paying more for the app that controls the sound for that app than the app itself.
That's actually a really good question. We came across a similar thing where I think Mal was beeping at the beginning of Big Sur, even when it was in Do Not Disturb mode. It was a bug. And the only solution around that was to use the wonderful app from Aroga Amoeba, which is Sound Source, which you can individually control the app audio. But definitely check with the developer first. And our last question, which is always an intriguing one. How can I change the Big Sur login wallpaper? And when I describe this, I don't mean the wallpaper of your desktop. It's the wallpaper before you sign in.
I mean, I get this asked this a lot, and I know, Craig, you know a lot about this too, but there's no good answer because some of the things that you would normally do sometimes work for some people and sometimes don't. And I think there are many variables, like, for instance, the security chip that's in your Mac, the T1 versus the T2 that's in your Touch ID. There's also whether you have File Vault turned on and whether you have guest account enabled. All of these things change how security works on your Mac. And the reason security is important is because when you're not logged into an account, technically, you shouldn't have any access to any information in that account, including the desktop wallpaper or the setting for the desktop wallpaper. So it gets tricky to try to set something for when you're outside of that security zone. You're not logged in yet. So what can the system tell about what you want at that point you're not logged in? But there are solutions. Technically, if everything's working perfect on my new M1 MacBook Pro, which has a T2 chip in it with Touch ID, and has File Vault turned on, if I go and set the desktop background to something in the account and I lock the screen, I see that desktop background, the one I've customized. And if I log out, I see it as well. But if I restart the Mac and I'm at the login screen after restart, I don't. I see the default multicolored Big Sur background. But that's very specific to exactly how I have my machine set up. What have you found, Craig?
So that's a really good question. My first thought is, why would somebody want to do this? The only scenario I could think of is if you are a business where the office has got branding and you all want a generic screen with some branding in it, or if you're a university or educational building. I know that's a particular favorite of those. I used to work looking after Macs in a network for a university, and that was always a custom question. On Big Sur, this isn't as easy as it makes out to try and make this change. And yes, I do agree with you, Gary. It may or may not work dependent on the machine. But from doing some digging and some playing this afternoon, I discovered that if you go into System Preferences and under Accounts, you have to physically right click on the icon of your account, which then brings up an advanced display window. And because Big Sur is set up in a way that the operating system is separate to where your personal documents are stored, there is another security caveat to that. And to do that, you need to have the UID of your Mac, so the unique identifier number of the Mac, as a file name to then be able to get into the cache folder to adjust this. I'll happily put the method in the show notes to explain this much easier, but it's not a simple fix. But back to my first comment is, why would you want to do this in the first place?
And then the second problem you'll have, which I guess both of you will agree with, is that no sooner do you put a software update in, than the whole thing gets wiped.
Yep.
So unless you're planning on keeping in an educational environment on an intranet and it doesn't access the internet and it doesn't update, you're going to have a lot of annoyed individuals that it keeps changing. And remember that Apple did this originally for security, and any system which you put in can be taken out because they may decide, by the way, in this new update, we've taken out that system. So I would be cautious, especially if you're not the most patient or tech literate. One of the things you would have to do is you'd have to turn off a security setting when you first log onto your computer, and you'd have to go to terminal. That's designed to prevent malicious files from getting in. So if you had a malicious file on your computer, whilst it reboots, it could get into the launch bit and it could cause you problems. Or what's more commonly a problem is the fat finger problem. You mistype something and then you end up screwing up your computer and Apple goes, did you really mean to do this? No, but now I can't get out of it. So unless you're patient and tech literate, I wouldn't suggest you go down this route, is the short answer. Just for clarity, the login screen or the wallpaper you're talking about is called Launch D. Like most things that you do to customize your computer, you've just got to remember that it will always come with a risk.
Since this is being asked by a lot of people, even though it's not something I look to do, I would love to see Apple add this in. You know, right now you could set a message for your login screen, you know, so you can put your phone number or an email, you know, so somebody finds the Mac, you know, if you lost it, they can return it to you or whatever. I would love to see right next to that, just a simple choice of the desktop background to use, or even a color that you could set, you know, just so you could set it to a solid color. Just some nice little thing, since it's obvious that people want this, allow us to do it in some future update. It would be nice.
Thinking about it, you can do it on every iOS device. Whenever you turn your phone back on or your tablet back on, it's going to be your custom image. So why not the Mac?
That's an easy thing for Apple to add in the future. And then they could put it as a bullet point. Yeah, you know, Tim Cook can put it up there as a bullet point and say, look what we've added.
Sadly, we're running out of time for today's show. But before we say goodbye, let's hear a little bit more about Gary, a little bit about yourself and how listeners can find some more information or how they can get in contact with you.
Yeah, so I have a site, macmost.com, and I post daily videos, usually about Macs, sometimes iPhones and iPads. They're tutorials. So I'm all about how to do things, you know, how to do things on your Mac and the apps on your Mac, Pages, Numbers, Keynote, iMovie, you know, Finder, and everything, you name it. So I have a YouTube channel. It's the same, the stuff, the videos I post to my website, I also post to YouTube, and there's a podcast as well. I have a weekly newsletter, so you don't have to keep going back to the site. Every Thursday morning, I update everybody on, you know, here's the new videos for the week. There's a question and answer forum at MacMost as well. People can ask me questions. And sometimes if they're good questions, I make videos on them also, as well as answer them. I also have other things at MacMost or online courses as well that I do. But most of the stuff is free. You just go to MacMost and sign up for the newsletter. It's a free newsletter, free videos every weekday. And you can learn a little something new every day that you can do with your Mac.
Would you say it's open to everybody? There's not necessarily a particular level of understanding of Mac.
I, you know, it's a variety. Every day is something different. And sometimes it's the beginner level. You know, sometimes I'll label these like Mac basics. It'll be like Mac basics using the dock. And then the next day, maybe doing overlays in iMovie, advanced iMovie thing, or something advanced in Pages, or something with the terminal. So, you know, as the week goes on, you'll find stuff that's advanced, stuff that's beginner, stuff that's intermediate, stuff that's for people that use a certain app like Keynote or something on the Mac. Other times then I'll talk about the iPhone and iPad. So it's a whole variety. I try to get something for everybody.
One recommendation I will personally give is something that will also help some recent topics that we've covered. We did quite a big section on automation recently, and Gary's videos on learning Automator are great. For anybody that wants to start, please, more of these videos. They're awesome.
Yeah, I actually did it. I did a beginner's course on Automator early this year. Just like I call it a mini course, because it's just 10 videos instead of like 40 videos or something. So it gets you really quickly into Automator. But I do my regular videos. I'll just come up with ideas of things to do in Automator. Usually I like to program with JavaScript in Automator as opposed to AppleScript. But sometimes it doesn't even involve coding. Just, you know, how to use the actions inside Automator to make quick actions or standalone apps or folder actions or whatever you want to do. So I enjoy doing those, because as somebody who has a programming background, and I still do a lot of programming and developing apps, you know, it's nice to be able to teach some of that as well as the general Mac stuff.
Because I don't know if people are familiar, but Gary makes lots of games. Could you tell us a little bit more about some of the games that you've produced?
That's how I started out, is making, first it was web-based games. I was one of the pioneers in the 90s. And a lot of my web-based games, when the iPhone came out and the App Store came out, I started taking some of those and making mobile games from them. So a lot of the web-based games are gone because, you know, those kind of sites, they're, you know, not around anymore. Flash isn't around anymore, that kind of thing. But the mobile apps, I've been able to take some of those and create some new ones that are now mostly free games that you can download in the App Store for iPhone or iPad.
In the time that you've been making the games, how have you seen the transition from different types of code?
I started doing web-based games in the 90s, and so I had to work with whatever browser technology was out there. So at first it was specific things, like if you remember Shockwave back in those early days, that was really the only way to make web-based games, and then Flash came around. But then after a while, JavaScript became the way to do it, or, you know, I usually call it HTML5, because it's a combination of JavaScript and CSS and HTML and then some server-side things. And the great thing about those kinds of games, and I still have several sites that are based on HTML5, is they work in any browser. You don't need any special plugins. You certainly don't need Flash. But at the same time, I would take some of my old Flash games, and you can use the same code for Flash games in something called Adobe Air. And I was able to use Adobe Air to make mobile games for both iOS and for Android. And then recently, I've been further evolving out of Adobe Air to developing games natively in Swift in Xcode, just before the iPhone and iPad, of course. Can't really make the Android games with that, but that's fine because my main interest is making games for the iPhone and iPad.
On that topic, how do you feel about iOS apps running on the M chips? Do you think that's really helpful?
Oh yeah, that's great because being able to develop just one app and have it run on eventually be all the Macs. Right now it runs just on the new M1s. That's been great. And a lot of my apps work well with the cursor on a Mac is, you know, I've got this one pointer, so you can touch one spot. So with multi-touch, it doesn't really work as well. But fortunately, most of my games require that kind of single touch or tapping on the iPhone or iPad with a finger. So it translates really well to working on a Mac instead of having to make a Mac version. I could just allow people to download the iOS version on their Mac. So it's a whole new a whole new market, kind of. You know, eventually, after a few years go by and everybody has M class Macs and not the Intel Macs, I'll be able to tell people my games work on iPhone, iPad, and Mac.
And I've got one last question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
If someone was starting out and considering looking at coding, mm-hmm. what would you recommend as a starting point? Where would I go?
Yeah, I mean, especially if they want to get into developing apps, whether it's for the Mac or iPhone or iPad, Apple has some great tools. You don't need to pay any money to Apple to get Xcode. You can download Xcode. They have all these learning resources that are free online, to, you know, whether they're videos or PDFs you can download to learn Swift. And Swift is a pretty good language to begin coding on. But the most important thing about doing it that way is you can see results right away. If you've got a Mac and you can create an app, really, it doesn't take much to go through one of their examples, create the app and the example, and then start modifying it on your own and see it actually running on your Mac, which is really important. If you're just getting started in programming, you want to be able to see results and be able to show somebody else, oh, look, here's a little game I made. Here's a useful utility I made, and it's running on my Mac, and I could give you a copy of it as well, and you can have it running. So that's a good place to start right there.
That's brilliant. I'm sure that will intrigue some people. And I know lots of topics recently, because we've all been in a lockdown situation, people have had time on their hands. An interesting story I read, especially here in the UK, a girl had just finished her master's degree. I think it was in law. And in the time of the lockdown, she was intrigued by coding and learned how to use Swift code and has completely redesigned her career going forward.
Coding is really goes across all different professions and interests, and coding's always a useful skill to have. I get a lot of people asking me, oh, how can I, this is my interest, I'd like to make an app with this, but I don't know coding, you know, and that's the missing piece that they've got. If they knew a little coding, they might actually be able to, if not create the app on their own, at least work with somebody else to build it.
Brilliant. Thank you. Sadly, we've come to the end of our show for this evening. Thank you very much to everyone that's been listening, firstly, most importantly, and also our guests this evening. Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate the time that you've taken to spend with us.
Thank you very much.
And we'll also say thank you to Alistair this evening. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been enjoyable this evening.
And not forgetting the mathematician of the team, Tina. Thank you very much.
It's great to be here. It's been an interesting chat.
Thank you, Tina. And it's goodbye from me. Thank you for listening. Until next time, stay safe.